This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more, and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzles. Our lessons in confidence today. I want to talk to you a little bit about the politics of envy and how it's a little bit annoying. How if you sort of discuss issues with wealth accumulation and, you know, people hoarding so much of the wealth, that ends up translating to, ooh, you're just jealous of them. You just want to be them. Right? So I watched this thing recently. It was just some YouTube video, and it was discussing the life, like day in the life of an average billionaire, right? And this guy, he had like 10 mansions all down this big Hollywood Boulevard sort of road, right? You know, all these mansions all down one road, and he had, you know, 50 servants, right? And so the servants and the chefs, he had like 6 chefs, and they would all do the cooking in what was called the cooking house, right? And that was one massive mansion, right? That was probably the size of like that entire building that's back there, right? And so the chefs would cook all the food in the cooking house, and then they would bring that to the dining house, and then the family would sit and eat in the dining house. And then they also had a playhouse for all the children to just sit and play. Then they had what was called the main house, which I imagine was where they slept and did like maybe their basic watching the telly and like showering and stuff like that. They also had like a garden house, which in this massive stately sort of garden with like probably like 10 gardeners keeping it up and all that kind of thing. He had like a collection of cars, all classic cars, various types of car, Range Rovers as well for the, you know, if he needs more boot space and that kind of thing. He obviously had various chauffeurs for each, you know, person to take them wherever they need to go, that kind of thing, right? He also had 3 pilots on standby and 2 private jets. And I was looking at all this utter opulence, and I was sort of thinking to myself, say if I had, say, $5 billion, right? Would I want this? Would I want all of this stuff? And I thought to myself long and hard, and I tried to think genuinely and honestly, and I try and empathize with their situation because they have so much money, which also means they have so much power, which then translates into responsibility to use that power for some kind of good, at least for the good of the people that you know, right? Even if that counts nepotism, corruption, all that kind of thing. And I thought, and I tried to empathize with all of that, and then I sat and thought, would I want all of this? And the honest answer was absolutely fucking not. I sort of sat to myself and I thought, what would I want? If I could have all the wealth, say unlimited money, money's not a problem, what would I have? And I thought, right, it'd be nice to have like maybe a 2-bedroom apartment in the middle of London, right? Maybe along the Thames, maybe quite high up so I could have a nice little view over the river, that kind of thing. Maybe a balcony so I could go out and have a fag, right? That would be nice. You know, a nice bed, all that kind of stuff. DuPont bed, you know, the decent sort of brand bed so you get a good night's sleep. And then it'd be nice to have like a house in the country. So that's 2 houses. And then, you know, whichever one I'm not using, I might rent out on the Airbnb, something like that. And then I thought, okay, well, what kind of car would I want? Well, my dream car would be like a 1980s Volvo. You know, those big long ones where they, shut up, where you keep all the dogs and stuff in them and all that kind of thing. Like you keep loads of dogs in the back. You see people carrying golden retrievers and German shepherds in them and things like that. I thought that would be quite nice. And my girlfriend would like a Chevy sort of like 60s classic car. And I thought, it'd be fun to have both of those. That's it, 2 cars. This is already a decent amount of opulence. This is already more opulence than I would necessarily immediately go for, right? But I thought that's the max, that's the peak of riches for me, right? And then it would be nice to, you know, buy like my friends a house and stuff like that, buy my parents a house, all that sort of crap. You know, that'd be nice, right? And do that kind of thing for other people. And I thought, well, hang on, a lot of people end up getting like, you know, sucked in by the money and the numbers and that kind of thing. And they end up wanting stuff that they would never would have wanted if they were poor. Like Nicolas Cage going out and buying loads of dinosaurs. That's why he has to do all these random crap films, because he keeps running out of money, because he keeps spending it on dinosaur skeletons, right? And I thought, would I end up doing that? What kind of thing would I collect? I'd probably collect guitars, synthesizers, and build up some kind of music studio. That would probably suck in a lot of money. All right, so that's a few different little layers of opulence. Maybe I'd buy like a red camera, you know, just to use, maybe some nice lenses, that kind of thing. And then I tried to think beyond that, and I really couldn't think of much. You know, like a nice little bit of furniture, not anything super expensive, but as long as it's comfortable and it's nice, you know, that'd be nice. Maybe 60-inch plasma telly, you know, that'd be all right. That kind of thing. I wouldn't want a PS5, I've got a PS3. And I haven't even played all the games on the PS3 yet. There's loads of games left to play. So what am I going to do with a PS5? Because I've got all these games left to play. I haven't even finished Dark Souls 2, right? I know you can get Dark Souls 2 on the PS5 through like some kind of collector's edition, right? But it's going to look exactly the same anyway. So I don't really see the point, because I don't think the graphics really got that much better. But anyway, I was thinking about all of this. Like, this is what I would want if I had infinite money. And then I thought about how that level of wealth compares to the amount of wealth that is actually being used and the opulence that is being enjoyed by people that have like billions of dollars or even hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, your super yachts, your mega yachts, your 10 mansions down the Hollywood Boulevard and like all your servants and stuff like that. I wouldn't want servants. I'd maybe get like a house cleaner to come in after each of the guests of the Airbnb, but that's it. I wouldn't want a house cleaner coming in and like rooting through all my possessions, you know, because they do that. Like, come on, don't be stupid. I've spoken to cleaners and they do take a little cheeky look, right? And that's fine. I'd do the same thing if I was a cleaner. Hence, I'm not a cleaner, right? But you know what? I thought about how there is so much inequality in the world, right? And how it's something like 8 people own like 30, 40, 50% of the wealth, something like that. And then there's, you know, billions of people living in poverty. There's people living in huts, like 10 to a room, under an ironclad thing that they built themselves with like plumbing that's barely working and all this sort of stuff, and electricity that goes down all the time. And I thought, well, hang on, how is it fair that some people have this, 10 mansions that they don't need? And you know that whole saying of like money doesn't buy you happiness, and rich people like to say that. So they're saying how money doesn't buy them happiness, but at the same time, they wouldn't like give up some of the money to those people that live in poverty who are sad because they live in poverty, because like if I had to sleep 10 to a room under an iron fucking clad roof, I wouldn't be happy either. You know, imagine when it rains, all the noise, it'd be terrible getting to sleep, and you probably can't afford headphones to like put on, like, and you can't get internet, so you can't listen to like podcasts and stuff. You'd have to download them, you'd have to go to a library, and the library might not be like for 30 miles because of the lack of infrastructure in this country, like whatever country it might be. I'm thinking like Bangladesh or like Kenya or something like that, right? And I started thinking, so they have so much wealth, at the same time they say that money doesn't buy them happiness. And yet at the same time, they don't want to give up that money for this sort of thing. And if you point this out, then you're just jealous of the fact that they want all this money. And that doesn't seem like it's completely right, you know? And maybe I am just jealous. Maybe I just want, you know, $1 billion and a super yacht. Maybe deep down I want that, but I just don't see it because I can't achieve it in this like state, you know? And there's that whole argument that rich people worked for their money. You know, and some of them, you know, maybe they started off with like a $10 million grant from their father and they managed to build that up into like a $1 billion business. You know, that's all right. I'm not someone that would sort of say like the likes of like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and that are like stupid, lazy people. But I don't think that they work 10 million times harder than the rest of us. You know, sure, maybe they work hard. Maybe they're very entrepreneurial. Maybe they do all this sort of stuff. And sure, maybe they deserve something back for that. But they don't deserve such an insane level of opulence that people have to live in poverty and endless suffering just to accommodate that. You know, and that just doesn't seem like it's completely right to me. And I tried to think, how could we sort of even the balance whilst ensuring that there is still the level of progression and aspiration for people to think, okay, I should try hard so that I can achieve this thing. Because people want more than what they have. The grass is always greener on the other side, right? And so people always want something and they need an incentive to work towards that thing. And that's where the defense of capitalism comes in. It's like, right, so if you work hard for something, you will get it, right? And obviously we all know living in the real world that that doesn't necessarily translate to reality, because look where I am now, right? I'd say I work fairly hard, right? Not to toot my own trumpet or anything. I'm not like a lazy person necessarily. And I'm sat in front of this. It looks like shit, right? There's so many people that are walking past that probably work even harder than I do, doing like 70-hour weeks, working two jobs so that they can ensure that their like two kids are sorted out. Maybe there's like single mums and single dads that are trying to ensure that their kids get food on the table that day, and they have to endlessly worry about the rent and or whatever, you know, and the bills being paid and this kind of thing. And maybe they're taking out loans from one bank and then using the loan from that bank to pay off another loan from another bank. And they're like, it's this whole intermingled complex economy that's come from the credit trap. And I kind of thought, well, hang on. So there's people out there that don't have to worry about any of this, that are born into this wealth, right? Because so many of these people that have this level of money and resources come from a place of privilege. They come from a place where they were able to, you know, take a risk. They were able to put down £20,000 or whatever onto their first business without really having to worry about it. You know, there's people that can go into the stocks and put like £3,000 into the stocks. Like, some people can't afford to put £3,000 in the stock. Some people can barely afford to put like £20 away per month. Some people are losing money every month and they have to endlessly take on little side hustles and gigs and stuff like that. Like, you ever go outside a McDonald's and see the amount of Uber drivers like that are just sat on their motorbikes, just like pissing about on their phone, just going, okay, bored. And they have a little chat. They're not getting paid for this, right? They're waiting for a job to come through so that they can get like £6-7 on some delivery. And then take into account that they have to pay for the petrol for their motorbike, right, and the time that they're spending, they're not necessarily making very much for the amount of work that they're doing, right? And maybe you could just say that they're stupid and like, you know, this entrepreneur is smart because he cracked the code. But not everyone can crack the code. And I don't mean that in like a, you know, emotive sort of way, like not everyone is intelligent enough to do it. I don't think the logistics would work. Say if everybody was an entrepreneur, who'd be the consumer for all these various products that are being bought out? Say if everyone was a billionaire, how would that even function? Because money would then just become devalued. We can't all be super rich. It's physically impossible because there aren't enough resources on planet Earth to accommodate that, right? And so what you kind of need to do is to try and even out the balance, because, you know, if 8 people own 40% of the wealth, is the idea that we want everyone in the world to be like those 8 men? Is that going to be realistic? Is that possible? Absolutely fucking not. But is it possible? Like, I did a calculation a few months ago, and forgive me if I've forgotten the exacts of it, but I took like the top like 100 richest people, and I then divided the amount of wealth that they all had, their net worth, and I divided that by 8 billion, right? And it worked out to something like you could do a single payment of like £30,000 to every single person on planet Earth. That's children, that's old people, that's people living in Lagos, that's people living in Nigeria, that's the same thing. People living in America, Australia, China, every single place on planet Earth, every single person could get £30,000 just from the top 100 men, right? And I thought, that's not right. Because then if you extrapolate that further to maybe the top like 1% in general, you could then pretty much give everyone like £300,000, okay? And that's enough for every single person to be able to buy a house, buy a property, get on the property ladder, or to invest in their own business and to do something like that. They did this experiment where they gave people from all across the world the equivalent of £100,000 in their region, right? And this is all over the world, like Caribbean, Africa, America, Australia, like everywhere around, right? And what they noticed was, yeah, some people ended up squandering the money, right? Some people, quite a lot of them, a large percentage, use that towards getting a mortgage or starting a business or doing something to further their development. They essentially invested that money even into liquid assets, liquidity or assets or whatever it might be, or a business or anything like that. Or maybe they just gave it to their grandchildren, you know? So I feel like that sort of says, one, that people on the ground level of the impoverished working class, I suppose, are generally good people. Because if you did that for the top like 1%, you gave them the equivalent amount for them, I think most of them would keep it for themselves. Isn't there that stat that something like 90% of CEOs are psychopaths? Something like that? I can't remember the exact statistic, but maybe it's like, you know, bad for me to even say that. But if you look it up, there's something like that. Maybe it's 70%, I don't know. But all of this stuff comes together, and it comes back down to the politics of envy and how I'm just jealous, of the people at the top, because they have something that I don't, right? But the thing is, they have way, 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 way more than I could ever possibly want. I feel like my little thing of an apartment in central London, a house in the country, two cars, like, yeah, that's a little bit materialistic, and I'm going max with my materialism here. Really, I'd be happy with just one little like house just for like me and my girlfriend to live in and just like be comfortable, you know? And not have to worry about the next rent payment. That's all I'd want. That's it, right? I wouldn't want any of these sort of things. And if I got any money on top of that, it would go straight back into investing in this channel or investing in business, that kind of thing. I wouldn't really hoard it. I'm not a materialistic person. I don't, oh, shut the fuck up. I don't want for much. That was a voice crack and a half, but I really don't want for much. I mean, maybe it's virtue signaling for me to say that I don't want a super yacht and I don't want to have mad cocaine parties with a load of fucking degenerate fucking like Hollywood billionaires. I just don't want that. That doesn't appeal to me in the slightest. I'd rather get my real mates around for a barbecue or like, you know, make them a dinner or, you know, just go down to the pub and have a few drinks, you know? That's all I'd really want for. I don't see the appeal of this extreme level of opulence. But maybe it just because I don't understand it means that they shouldn't have it, you know? That's also an argument. But I feel like when you consider the fact that there's so many people that are living in such abject poverty, there are so many miserable people that are having to work so hard to get so little, and then you compare that to people that have so much and yet they do so little for it, and you consider the inequality that comes from that, and how it could easily be remedied if these people just let go of some of their materialism, some of their greed, how easily they could fix so many of the problems in the world, and yet they won't. And yet it's me being jealous that is the problem. Me wanting for something is the problem. And it's hard to sort of say that I'm not a little bit jealous. I'm not a little bit, you know, envious of the fact that they have all this stuff and they don't have to worry. You know, they don't have to worry about the next rent payment or whatever. Yeah, sure, I'm a little bit jealous of that because I do. And that's, I guess, all right because, you know, there's only so many people in the world that can be rich according to the top 1%. And if you consider that you can easily divvy out that wealth that they all own towards everyone on planet Earth and how everyone could end up living so much happier, that the level of happiness across the world would vastly increase, right? If some of these people just gave up stuff that they don't even want, because apparently money doesn't buy your happiness. So if money doesn't buy your happiness, let go of some of it and let someone who lives in abject poverty just stop living in abject poverty and you know, make their life a little bit and make their family's lives a bit easier. That's all I'm saying. Maybe it's communist to say that. I don't know. But anyway, that's my little rant over. Thank you so much for watching this video. I hope you don't think that I'm a lefty woke socialist for this, but yeah, take care everybody, bye bye. That's a terrible closer. Oh well. Hey up everybody, my name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzles, our lessons in confidence. And today, I want to talk to you a little bit about music equipment and how more expensive equipment does not necessarily correlate to better music. Now, for the past 4 years, I've been recording music and I've been using Harley Benton guitars. Now, Harley Benton guitars are like the cheapest of cheap guitars that you can possibly get. You can get one guitar for like 80 quid, right? And they're all like replicas of, you know, it's the various standard models of guitar, you know, your Stratocasters, your Jazzmasters, all that sort of stuff, your Les Paul. Like, you can get a Harley Benton version of basically any guitar you want, right? And they've got the cheapest of cheap sensors in them, the cheapest of cheap pickups in them. They're made of really cheap wood. They're made really cheaply. And you know what? I've been using them with the stock pickups in them. I've not done any adjustments to them. And you know what? I think they sound fine. I think they sound all right. You know, I put them through the amp, and the amp isn't necessarily the most expensive amp ever. I use a Vox. Voice 25 or something like that. I can't remember what the name of the amp is, but it was like 100 quid. It wasn't like some mega amp. It wasn't like the loudest amp in the world or anything like that. And the guitar isn't the best guitar in the world. And you know what? What makes the music good isn't the equipment, it's the talent that goes into it. And my music has gotten better and better and better, kind of as my equipment has gotten worse and worse and worse. Because when I first started, I was using a lot of my granddad's equipment. And he had all like kind of nice original Stratocasters from the 70s and all this sort of stuff that cost a lot more money. And he had a big Vox stack sort of thing. He had loads of stuff like that. And I was using all of that for my very first few albums, right? And my first few albums are wank, right? But then I ended up using my own stuff, right? And just finding that the music got better as I got worse equipment. Right, and it wasn't because of the equipment itself, it was because I, as a guitarist and a general musician, was improving. And the same happened to you. As you get better and better at making music, you'll find yourself probably getting less and less precious about the sort of equipment that you're actually using. You don't need to be a gearhead. If you look at like most of the famous musicians out there, right, like Noel Gallagher, I remember seeing an interview of him where it, apparently it was only in about 2015 that he found out what the tone knobs on amps were and kind of used for, because he just used to whack like bass, treble and mids all the way to 10. And then when someone said, you know, you can kind of dial them in to hone in a tone, he was like, what? Can you? Oh, okay. And he tried it and he found he really liked it. But he'd done so many albums, he'd probably done like 15 albums using just everything turned all the way to 10, because it's not the equipment that makes the music. The music makes itself. And you, the artist, make the music. Because music isn't a recollection of equipment being used. It's a combination of lyrics, melodies, rhythms, progressions, ideas, so on and so forth, and ambiances, right, in general, okay? So you don't need good equipment to make good stuff. You don't need the highest, latest and greatest thing. You don't need that thing that's on your eBay wish list. You don't need to buy it. It costs $2,000. You don't need the fucking thing, all right? Because say you get that thing, right, and it comes to your door and you use it and you really like it, right, and you put it on a song, right, and then it just becomes your new thing. Is your music going to get better as a result of it? No. It's going to sound basically exactly the same as it did before, right? It might sound more expensive, possibly, depending on what it is, right? Because obviously there are some things where if you just get absolute the cheapest thing, it will sound cheap, right? But as long as you can differentiate and use your intelligence and your common sense to kind of figure out what sounds good and what doesn't, that's the important thing. You can use the cheap drums. The main reason that people get more expensive drum kits isn't because they sound better, it's because they last longer. The reason that people get these expensive guitars from the 70s and stuff isn't because they sound better, it's because they last longer. And a guitar from the 70s costs like $4,000, right? And a Parley Benton guitar costs about £80, right? So how many Harley, like, and a Harley Benton has lasted me about 4 years, right? Say it breaks tomorrow, right? So you're not really paying any more. At the end of the day, you're paying £800 for 40 years compared to £4,000 for 40 years. And I just think that you'll save money in the long run by not worrying so much about this stuff and just making what feels true to you, using the equipment that you feel comfortable with, and not worrying so much about the next best thing that you can get. Because once you get that thing, there'll be another fucking thing that you'll want. And then you'll want that and you'll feel like you're missing out on something because you don't have it. And then once you get that, there'll be another thing that you'll be missing out on. And all this money could go towards more important things like keeping a roof over your head or food in front of you or whatever, right? And you could put the money that, and you could put your time and dedication towards making better music, right? So I hope that kind of made some level of sense, in that whatever equipment that you've got at the moment, right, be it the cheapest of the cheap sort of thing, or maybe you're just like borrowing like your parents' instruments or whatever, you know, just use stuff that feels right to you. Just use whatever you can and make music with whatever you have access to. You ever go on like the YouTube short stuff? There's so many like people on there that are very talented that use like stupid little things to make cool music. Like I saw someone, he had like a Toys R Us sort of fiddle sort of thing, and he was covering Dream Theater with it, right? Like it shouldn't sound that good, but because he's got the talent to do that, he can make it, right? And you know what? If you master your instrument and it's a shit instrument, because like the guitar neck on the Harley Bentons isn't the smoothest, right? So if I was to move to a more expensive guitar with a cleaner neck or whatever, right? And it would probably make my fingering a bit easier to do. My skill level would probably improve as a result of that, because I essentially jumped into the deep end and I swum to the shallow end. And now I can stand in the shallow end and float. Whereas before I would have just sunk, right? Because it's the It's the doing what you can with what you have mentality, essentially, because you have what you have, so you might as well use it rather than pining for something far away that you can't have right now. And then only once you have that can you make the good stuff, because you're never going to go to Abbey Road and record an album there. You're never going to play the Red Rocks. You're never going to do all these sort of things. So don't try and make music and then sit and get yourself down because it's not on the level of like the Beatles recordings or whatever, because they had money behind them in order to go and do that sort of stuff, right? You can make whatever your sound as good as it possibly can, and then it will sound as good as the Beatles because you've made songs that are interesting, right? And you've done something that resonates with other people. That's the key thing. And it doesn't actually need to resonate with other people. As long as it resonates with you, that's the important thing. As long as it resonates with yourself, sod everybody else, as far as I'm concerned. That's the way I would see it. So I hope you managed to get something out of this. I hope this was a fairly logical sort of point that I'm trying to make here, in that you don't need better equipment and that you don't need to get yourself down because you haven't got good equipment, because some of your favorite guitarists, some of your favorite instrument doers, right, they started with nothing. They started with bugger all. Look at Bushy One String. He's got a one string guitar and he managed to make something out of that. Look at Madhu Mattar, or however you pronounce his name. He started off in a country where they made it illegal to play instruments. And he made his own guitar out of like wood and string and buckets and stuff. And he managed to learn the guitar that way. And then once he was able to buy a guitar, because I think they reverse the law, he was brilliant at it because he'd spent so long practicing with this utter pile of shit, right? And, you know, I think it's a much more interesting story for Madhu Mattar to go and do that with the limited resources and capacity that he had than it is for someone like, I don't know, the members of Dream Theater who went to Berklee Music School, dropped out of music school to start a band and then just became successful. Which of these two stories is more interesting? I would say the Madhu Mattar one is more interesting. And that's not to denigrate some of Dream Theater's music. I like a lot of Dream Theater's music, even some of the wanky stuff. But the point is that you don't need to get yourself down about your circumstances because you can still make great art with it. So thank you very much for watching this video, everybody. Hope you got something out of it. Take care. Have a great rest of the day. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozzles, our Lessons in Confidence. And today I want to talk to you a little bit about film equipment and how it doesn't matter what equipment you have. What matters is the story that you want to tell. So this camera that I'm using at the moment is a Canon C100 Mark I. It's a 12-year-old camera at this point. It came out in 2012. And when it came out, it cost $12,000, right? Now, I bought this camera for £600. Call that, I don't know, $900, let's say. So it depreciated a lot in value. And I bought it after it depreciated in value. But you know what? It's the same camera that does the same job. And just all that's different is the amount that people are willing to pay for it. I would never have spent £12,000 on this camera. And to be honest, I wouldn't spend £12,000 on any camera, really. I mean, I don't really see why I should do that, because at a certain point, the cameras that do cost this amount are going to get older and older, and as they get older and older, people will stop wanting them, they'll want new stuff, and I can be there to scavenge the old stuff. So when I got this, I got it on eBay. I got it on, you know, the bids. That's what eBay does. It does bidding and stuff like that, right? So I saw that it had zero bids and it had 2 days left on it. So I put down a bid. They listed it at £600, so I put down £600 and like one pence, right? And so for the next couple of days, I sort of sat there and kind of just hoped no one would bid on it. And, you know, I wasn't expecting much. I was expecting someone to bid on it because it's a Canon C100. It's a, like, Canon. It's a cinema camera. I thought, fucking, why isn't someone going to bid on it? No one ended up bidding on it, right? And it got to 1 hour left. And I was glued to the screen for that hour, refreshing that page, because I know how eBay works. People like to come in and snipe. That's what it's called, when someone comes in and bids at the very last second so that they can basically steal the thing away from the other person that already had the bid down. I knew that was possibly going to happen. And I was refreshing the page, kind of worried that I was going to not be able to get this camera. And no one sniped it. No one wanted it other than me. So result. So I got the camera. Next up, I had to get some batteries because it didn't come with batteries, and it took a specific type of battery. I don't know what kind of batteries it takes. I don't know how batteries work, but it needed special batteries, right? So I looked around, and on the Canon website, it listed them for like £200 a pop. I thought, oh, fuck, was that the catch? So I went back to eBay, and I found that on the like wholesale thing, just buying it direct, you could get one for like £150. And I thought, okay, that's a bit better. So maybe I could get one, and that would be a bit of a problem. But I kind of need two. I really need two for this sort of thing. And I was kind of worried about, like, what am I going to do? How am I going to make this work, you know? So what I thought I would do is go back onto the bids. And I found on the bids, there was one for £50. And this guy had a few of them. So I put down a bid of £50.01 on every single one. And I did the same thing again. And I sat there and I waited and I waited and I waited until they came to the last hour. And when I got to the last hour, no one sniped it. Again, on all three of them. So I got three batteries for a quarter of the price that I was supposed to get them for, right? And I bet when the Canon C100 first came out, Canon was selling them for a hell of a lot more than £200. So I managed to get the entire setup there for £750. Then I needed to get a lens. So I thought, what kind of lens should I get? I want like a long lens. I was doing events at the time, so I like, you know, like live events and stuff like that. So I wanted a long lens that could get that sort of thing, close-ups and stuff like that. So I found a 1988 70mm, 210mm lens. It's not the thing that this is being filmed on. It's a USM lens, so it's like the fairly like posh ones for the Canon, right? EF mount. And this lens came out in like 1988 or something, right? And it cost £60, right? You want to get like a proper USM sort of lens that does that sort of thing, that has that level of like 70mm, 210mm USM, you're probably looking at about £400. I got it for 60 just because I got the older one that people decided they don't want anymore because it's old and it's shit and it's decrepit, right? There's so many cheap, like, I remember I worked with one DP and he had what he called a Soviet lens, and it was like a weird aperture. It was like 27mm or something weird like that. And he liked using it every now and then because it gave him a specific look. It gave him this kind of dreamy sort of look that was really interesting. And I really liked it. And I asked him how much he paid for it. And he said, something like £20. £20 for a lens is fucking bargain. That's the sort of thing that if you went on Amazon and tried to find a lens for £20, you're probably looking at something that would be like, you know, like one of those Chinese knockoff sort of things that's going to like last for no time whatsoever. And you know, it worked. The lens worked really well because the mounts haven't changed in like the last 30, 40 years. So why can't I use older equipment? Why can't I use a 10-year-old camera? I don't need 4K. I don't need all these things because what are you watching this video in 4K? Did you watch the last video that possibly that had the option for 4K? Did you watch that in 4K? I doubt you did because honestly, 4K looks exactly the fucking same as HD anyway. And HD kind of looks the same as 720p. So it's all kind of the same thing. The only reason you might want a 4K camera is for clients, if clients want 4K. And kind of the reason that clients want 4K is because they think that they're getting something better because they're getting it in 4K. But you know what? When I have a job that requires 4K, I can rent out a camera that does 4K, £40, and I get paid like £1,000 for the job. Sort of whatever. And at some point, once I have enough money, I will get a 4K camera so I can stop doing that because it will save me money in the long run. But I don't think that camera would become my new main one. I think this camera, I've formed some kind of bond with this camera. And you do that with your equipment that's near and dear to you. Like a guitar, like David Gilmour with his Black Strat, and he was using that for so long. You form a relationship with your equipment. You know, this camera that I've had, it's been with me to various different countries. It's been with me all across the UK. It's been with me to weird places. It's been with me to, like, you know, studio events. It's been with me all over the fucking place, right? And I like this camera, and I've been on adventures with this camera, and me and this camera have had experiences together, right? And I've formed this relationship with this camera, and you will form a relationship with the equipment that you get, no matter what it is, because it will be special to you. And that's the key thing. Rather than trying to chase the greatest technical requirements or the biggest numbers or the latest, greatest thing, you know, this is a 10-year-old camera. And people are constantly like asking me what camera I film these videos on, saying that the videos look beautiful and all that sort of stuff. Like, by any, like, if you went onto like the videography subreddit or whatever, or I don't know, the filmmaker subreddit, they would probably tell you not to bother with this camera because it's old and it's shit and you can get new things that will have like 4K, or you can have new things that have this and that. There's a couple issues that I have with this camera. One is like the viewfinder. You can pull it out and you can rotate it, but not in any real useful way. Like, I can't see myself through the viewfinder. I can't rotate it that much, okay? And I'm not really sure why I can't do that. And on the Mark II, you can do that. Also, I can't really use this camera with a gimbal because some of the main functions are on this little side grip handle. And if you try and put the camera on a gimbal with the side mount thing, it doesn't fit whatsoever. And the balance is all fucked as well. So those are two little issues that were fixed with the Canon C100 Mark II, which I would consider getting at some point. And then I can use this C100 Mark I as like a B camera. I would consider getting that at some point, but at the moment, those cameras cost like 1,200 quid, and I don't really want to spend 1,200 quid on the camera. I'd rather wait for it to go down in price, because it's the same camera at the end of the day that at one point was the latest and greatest thing that people are super impressed by. All that's changed is time, right? Like, people look at Lawrence of Arabia and think Lawrence of Arabia looks great, but, you know, the camera itself is incredibly outdated. You know, like, you know how the whole thing of like they sent man to the moon with technology that isn't even like as good as your iPhone, right? And that's the iPhone like 1, not like the iPhone 16 or whatever they're on now, right? So whatever equipment that you want to get, try and get something that's old, but like not so old that it's become vintage that people want it again because of the oldness. Get something that nobody wants and make it your own. And make a style for yourself out of it. Because this camera, I don't really see anyone else filming with a Canon C100 these days. So I get to own this space, this cinematic landscape that the C100 can do. It's mine, basically, because I'm one of the few people that are actually using it. And there's so many people out there that are using the, I don't know, the Sony A7 Mark VI or the, I don't know, Panasonic GH8 or whatever. These like grand new cameras that came out in the past couple of years that have the latest and greatest things, right? You don't need these features. Are you going to use them? Sure, you might use them once or twice. Now I've used them, I'm bored of them, right? I'm not going to use them every single day. I don't need to film everything in 200 frames a second. I don't need to film everything in 8K. I don't need this stuff because all I need is a camera that has a good color science, is reliable, is sturdy, with a good battery life. That's all I need, right? As long as it looks nice, it's easy to use, and it functions, that's good enough for me, right? Because I'm going to put my camera through a lot of shit, right? Like, sorry. I put my camera through an awful lot of stuff, okay? And it's very, very, very hard for the camera to keep up with me. So I made sure to get a camera that could keep up with me, rather than getting something that is maybe like the Sony A7 sort of stuff. The batteries on those are awful. They barely last more than a couple hours. I wouldn't get any use out of that. It would be pointless to me, because even though it might have a nicer, sharper, crisper look, I don't see how it's necessarily better just because you can see more detail. Would this video be better if you could make out every like blade of grass? Would this video be better if you could see every, hang on, let me just find an actual rock or something. Would it be better if you could see every single ripple in absolute crisp detail and zoom in and hone in on every single molecule of that water? What does the texture of the water have to do with what I'm saying? And what does the lighting of whatever film you're trying to make have to do with the story that's at hand? Can you make the lighting fit the story? That's the key thing, rather than trying to make the story fit the technicalities, because, you know, there wouldn't be any point in filming something like if you're trying to replicate some kind of old style movie like 40s 50s sort of era cinema, you wouldn't film that on a Red. Why would you do that? And you spent all this money, so you might as well use a Red, but it's not what this is film is trying to do. So you would end up just filming something that just feels a bit like in at odds with itself and incompatible with its own nature. So I would say try and get something that works for you, and that's the key thing, rather than trying to get what people tell you is important to have. I hope you managed to get something out of this video, because it's quite important sort of as a topic to me, because I really took a risk with getting this camera. I was either going to get this camera or I was going to get the Sony A7 Mark III, and that costs like three times as much as this. And you know what? I'm so glad I didn't waste that money, because I wouldn't have enjoyed that camera anywhere near as much as this. I've used the Sony A7 Mark III, and don't get me wrong, it's a fantastic camera. But this is my camera. This is me. This camera feels like me in a way that the Sony didn't. So that's what I would say to you, is try and get something that feels you. And if you can make use of some old deals, get some like eBay thing that nobody wants anymore, then you're in the money. Literally as well, because you'll be saving money as well. So yeah, thank you very much for watching this video, everybody. Hope you have a good rest of the day. Bye-bye. God. Hey up, everybody. My name's Joshua Morrison, director of Johnny Mozza's Lessons in Confidence. And today I want to talk to you a little bit about making music and how I made 20 albums in 3 years and how exactly I did that and how it's a lot easier to make an album than people kind of make it out to be. If you sort of look at various making of albums and you see people in the studios, you see all this big equipment, you see the big mixing desks, you see the mixing engineer and you see the mastering guy and you see that there's various band members and they've got all this equipment, they've got, you know, giant Marshall stacks and they've got like 40-year-old Fender Stratocasters and they've got all these resources in order to make music, right? And then they come out and they bring out an album and they've got this huge promotional cycle around it and they've got money behind it and you might see an advert for it on the side of a bus or you might see an advert for it on the internet or you might just see a pop-up or whatever. And then you maybe go on the band's Facebook page and you see they're constantly promoting their new shows and their new thing and their new tour and they're getting interviewed here and there. And it might overwhelm you and make you feel like you're not a real musician because you don't have this, you don't have this level of success, but you are a real musician. Do you make music? If so, you're a musician. Have you ever made music? Even if it's just, you know, getting on your phone, getting the audio recorder app on your phone and just recording yourself playing the guitar, just a little song that you might have made up, or even just jamming to yourself. If you've done any of those things, you are a musician. Now, if you are a musician and you want to take yourself to the next level, maybe you want to make an album, it's very easy. What is an album at the end of the day? It's 40 to plus minutes of music, sometimes even less than 40 minutes. Some albums are like 20, 30 minutes long. So all you need to do is make some songs, put them in a group, and then release them. You know, you can put stuff onto Bandcamp for free, you can put stuff on SoundCloud for free, you can get a DistroKid subscription for like £1.50, you can get a Muse, I used to use a Muse, I think now you've got to pay for a Muse, so I've kind of come off it, and apparently all my music's being removed from a Muse, because I don't really want to pay the £15 a year for it, because I don't make £15 a year on that account, so there's no point in me really keeping the music on there, but either way, I've still made these albums. Now, when I first started off, I was pretty inept at playing guitar. I didn't really understand how to play the piano. I didn't know how to play any instruments or how to mix or master or anything like that. I didn't understand the concept of layering. I didn't understand, you know, harmony. I didn't understand melody. There were so many aspects to music that were just completely alien to me, like they were runes that I had to try and solve. And as you make more and more stuff, you will solve those runes and you will understand your place in the grander scheme of things. You know, are you someone that likes to do pop punk kind of stuff? Well, you might find that you're doing stuff in a certain way that maybe is a bit different from the standard Blink 182 sort of pop punk. Are you doing sort of lo-fi hip hop? Well, you might find that you're doing a particularly interesting kind of lo-fi hip hop that's relevant to you. Maybe instead of the usual sort of organs and like keyboardy sort of things, maybe you're doing more like acoustic guitar sort of lo-fi hip hop, or maybe you're even just creating a new genre. You don't know that you're creating a new genre. You didn't set out to create one, but maybe you just magically come up with one. And you can do all of those things because the possibilities are at your fingertips to do a bit of that or a bit of that, and that's playing the piano. But it can also be doing the keyboard and the computer keyboard, figuring out how you're going to mix and master your stuff, because you can do all of it on the internet as well. Even if it's just going on GarageBand and just coming up with something together out of that, you can do music in any particular way that you want. There's no right or wrong way at approaching music. I mean, when I first started making music, I recorded onto my phone. I would upload the thing from my phone onto Google Drive, download it from Google Drive, put it on my computer, put it from the computer into Audacity, and then layer it in Audacity, and then mix it in Audacity. And generally, it was putting a pull stretch effect on one chord. I'd play one chord, let it ring out, and then I would put that into Audacity and use that as kind of the backing ambiance for the rest of the stuff to kind of go on top of. Or maybe I would approach things in a bit of a different way, and I would sort of cut and splice things to make some kind of weird sampled, semi-interpolated from my own playing kind of thing. And, you know, I made weird experimental sort of stuff, and I made, you know, odd ambient-y kind of stuff. And then as time went on, I started wanting to do more stuff with drums and rhythm and that kind of thing. So I started progressing towards figuring out how to make drum loops out of that, or like just playing the drums on a Yamaha keyboard. And I started working that way. And, you know, you can just do that. You don't have to ask permission to make music. You don't have to ask permission to release music. You can just do it, because the internet is such a huge expanse. It's way bigger than everything that's here in the background, right? Imagine this was just an infinite expanse. That would be a drop in the ocean compared to what the internet has to offer. And if people enjoy what you're doing, they're going to enjoy what you're doing no matter if you've got $1 million behind you or you've got $1 behind you. It really doesn't matter, because what you are and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to create is unique to you, and no one else can replicate that but you. And that in itself is a commodity that people might want to be a part of. That's something that people might want to engage in. It's something that people might want to listen to and get some kind of emotive resonance from it. And if you can do that, and if you can find some people that resonate with your stuff, then you're doing it all correctly, as far as I'm concerned. There's no right or wrong way of doing music. It's not like you need to get to the studio and you need to have a band, or you need to mix it in this certain way, or you need to get it mastered in this certain way. There's no correct way of doing anything. And what I tend to notice is that, particularly in maybe the past 20, or actually for all of the musical history, the people that experimented and pushed at the boundaries were the ones that found the greatest success. The ones that people, when they were first starting out, kind of went, oh God, what are you doing? Can you just do it normally, please? Like, this is just, what the fuck is this? It's a load of bollocks. Can you just do it normally, please? And people will do that. You'll always have naysayers. You'll always have people trying to get you down. And that's okay. Because as long as you continue to just keep doing the thing that you're doing, that you enjoy doing, that brings you joy, if other people can find joy in it, then that's great. If they don't find joy in it, it doesn't matter, because you're finding joy in it yourself. You're sitting down, maybe listening to your track, and you're going, oh, yeah, I think I've got some in there. Oof, very nice. You know, and that's part of the magic of music, is that you can create that experience for yourself. And it's very, very easy. All you need, because what are most songs? Most songs are drums, bass, bit of guitar, maybe a bit of piano, maybe two guitars. What's that, 5 layers? Okay, brilliant. Vocals, 6 layers. So you record 6 things, say the song's 3 minutes long, times 6, that's 18 minutes. Add a maybe, you know, 12 minutes for the little like piffing around in between, right? Half an hour. Take that from the recording thing to the computer, do a bit of mixing. That's an hour, right? You don't have to make a song in an hour, but you can. And you might as well, because if you've got an hour free, if you're not doing anything anyway, I don't see why you shouldn't just make a song. And I don't see why you shouldn't just release it. I don't see why you can't do anything like that, because it's the way that you get started. Every journey begins with a single step, and everyone gets started somewhere. Look at Brockhampton, for instance. They got started on a Kanye West forum or something like that, or Kendrick Lamar forum or something like that. It's just one guy posted, I want to make a hip-hop supergroup. And they made a hip-hop supergroup, and they made some demos, and they made some music at first that they probably never released, music that was probably god-fucking-awful. And they tweaked things, and they figured out their sound, and they figured things out. But they would slowly release little things, probably sharing amongst themselves, and then once they got to a point where they're happy, they start releasing stuff, and then they start releasing some quite good stuff. And look, I'm not the biggest Brockhampton fan, but it doesn't matter if I'm a fan of them or not. People resonated with what they had to say. People resonated with their tunes, and people resonated with their sounds, and so on and so forth. And they ended up finding great success in the music scene as a result of that. And now people end up copying Brockhampton, and then people end up copying whoever copies Brockhampton now, and so on and so forth, because that's the nature of inspiration, is that you get inspired by watching a certain thing or listening to a certain thing. You go, God, yeah, I want something like this, but with a bit of this added on. You know, maybe I want a bit of Brockhampton, but I want it combined with a bit of David Bowie, right? You could do that. It would probably sound a bit weird, but someone out there could probably make that sort of thing work. You can do these sort of things. You're free to engage in art, because art is a freeing process to allow people to express themselves. And if you're not expressing yourself, then what's the point of doing it, is the way that I would see it. So I made 20 albums in about 3 years, 10 of which are this thing called the Morrison Royalty Free Suite. And that was essentially me just learning and progressing. And then I also did some soundtracks for a few films and like friends films and so on and so forth. And then I made a couple other instrumental albums, and I made two albums with vocals on them. And, you know, a bunch of singles and little mini releases here and there and compilation albums that were just, I can release a compilation album even though I'm a nobody, because no one's heard this stuff anyway. If I can package it in a more interesting way that's more cohesive from what I originally had, and, you know, cut some of the crud and then just keep the good stuff from the past, I don't see why I can't do that, because the internet is a huge place and there's room for everyone to do what they need and do what they want. So each album probably took somewhere between 2 and 6 months to make. Some of them took a little bit longer, some of them took a little bit less time. I made one album in a day, I made one album in like 2 weeks, I made one album in like a month and a half, and then most of the albums took around 3 months. That's the average, I would say. And I feel like that's a good rate of making stuff, because that's what, one new killer song every like week or so. Say you got 10 songs on an album and it takes about 10 weeks to make an album. So you've got a new killer song each week for you to sit down and listen to and go, oh, fucking hell, this is all right, this. You know, I'm doing pretty decent here. This is all right. And why should I go the more traditional route of, you know, getting the demo and then taking it to a band and then taking that to a studio and then doing various demos of the studio and then sorting things out and then combining it all to make some kind of larger, more finalized mix and then taking that to a mastering engineer who's going to charge me like $800 for one song or for like 2 hours of a time or whatever. And then what, $800 every single time I want to make a song? I've made like 400 songs. I've probably released like 200 plus songs. 200 plus 800 is a lot of fucking money. That's 8,000, 80,000, it's 160 grand. I don't have that kind of money lying around. And if I did, I'd be getting a deposit on a mortgage, not putting it towards a fucking mastering engineer. Because you know what? I think that my music sounds all right, you know? Maybe you disagree. Maybe you think my music sounds like a load of amateur shite. That's totally fine. That's your prerogative. I think that some other people out there who are probably proud of their music, that I think their music's a load of shite. And that's all right. We can do that. We can have that kind of discourse and back and forth, or even just opinion on a certain thing. Because I'm not going to go and like put in the comments of some random like guy that's trying his best, you know, oh, your music's a load of shit, mate. You know, I'm going to try and maybe like, on Reddit, for instance, there's the We Are The Music Makers forum on Reddit, and they have this Feedback Sunday. I like to sometimes go on there and just give feedback to other people, and then I get feedback in return. And it's this nice sort of coalescing of various artists trying to help each other out. And because, you know, you've got a variety of artists, you've got some hip hop guys, you've got some punk guys, you've got some pop guys, you've got some EDM guys, you've got all these, you know, metalheads in there. You've got everything in one sort of space, and they're all these different perspectives are engaging with what you're doing, and they're able to see it from their own little sides. And sure, maybe I don't have much to offer someone who's making EDM, because I don't particularly listen to much EDM. So I don't understand the, you know, the genre, and I don't understand the norms of the genre. Maybe I might say that like, oh, I don't really like this particular aspect, but it turns out that aspect is like a staple of the genre and people want more of that rather than less. But you know what, it's my perspective, and other people have their perspectives on my stuff, and we can do that. We can have this discourse, and I think we should be, you know, proud of the fact that we can do that, and we should be proud of our works, even if they're a load of shite. Because you know what, what's a load of shite to one person is a load of gold to another. And what's you know, one man's junk is another man's treasure, all that sort of stuff. So why not go out there, start, and just make as much as you possibly can? Because I could have, instead of making 20 albums in 3 years, I could have made put all that time into making one album. Would that one album be 20 times better than the 20 albums that I made? I don't think so. I think maybe it would have been twice as good. That's fine. But would it have been 20 times better? If not, then I don't really see why it would have been worth my time, personally. And that's my perspective. Other people might disagree with that. They might think that it's better to hone and craft in private and then come out with your main thing at first. I would disagree with that, but other people would agree with that. And either approach works, because people have tried things in all manner of ways, you know. Not everyone has to be Buckethead, who releases like every single thing that he ever made, who's probably got somewhere along the lines of about 500 albums now. Some people want to be more like Franz Ferdinand, who've made 4 albums in 20 years. And they're good albums, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. You know, and I'm not saying to Franz Ferdinand, go make like 5 albums a year or whatever and keep doing that and just like churn a load of shit out. But there's no wrong way of doing things. So whatever approach works for you, that's the approach you should take. And I think that's going to be the general end of the video. So if you want to listen to any of these 20 albums, well, they're kind of all over the place, to be honest. Some are on YouTube. They're under loads of different aliases. Some are on YouTube, some are on Bandcamp, some are on Spotify. I'll link like maybe 3 or 4 of the good ones. If you go on my playlist, actually, I've got a playlist called Songs and Albums That I've Worked On. That's got all the core stuff that is, I think, pretty good. And then there's probably other stuff if you're that interested. And yeah, thank you very much for watching this video, everybody. Hope you managed to get something out of it. Hope you managed to get some kind of resonance or learn something or take something from this video and apply it to your own craft going forwards. And leave a comment below about how much music that you've made and of the percentage of songs that you have done, how many have you released? And how many of the songs that you've released are you still proud of to this day? So that's going to be it from me. Hope you have a good rest of the day and take care, everybody. Bye-bye. Train, right on time.